A return on investment today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Alabama is now ranked fifth in the nation for auto manufacturing. Officials there use tax incentives to attract foreign car companies to build in the state, and it's paid off.
In my business world, I would invest in a business and then expect to make money off of it. This is the same thing. We invested in this business.
Also, we go on the road with a caravan of Central American migrants making their way through Mexico. Turns out they're not all hoping to enter the U.S.
That is definitely a misconception that these 1,100 people are going to storm the border. You know, that's not the intention, or ever was.
Plus, one South African's enduring memory of Winnie Mandela.
She was, at the time when I grew up, our own Michelle Obama, if you like.
Those stories and more coming up today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World.
Until we can have a wall and proper security, we're going to be guarding our border with the military. That's a big step.
President Trump today said his administration was about to beef up security along the U.S.-Mexico border. No details on that plan were forthcoming, except that Trump said he talked to Defense Secretary James Mattis about it. This all comes on the heels of a Trump Twitter screed that highlighted the word caravan. Caravans of people are heading here, is how the president put it, as in heading to what he called our weak laws border. And there are not caravans. There is one caravan. Hundreds of Central American migrants have been marching together through Mexico, headed to the U.S. border.
No somos criminales. Somos trabajadores.
We're not criminals. We're workers, they've been chanting. The migrants say they've been traveling through Mexico together for safety reasons, so they wouldn't be preyed upon by criminals and authorities demanding bribes. Now Mexican officials say they're disbanding the caravan. BuzzFeed's Adolfo Flores has been traveling with the group. So, Adolfo, Mexican authorities say they're dispersing the march. What's going on? Is it getting dispersed?
Depends on who you ask. The Mexican government says they are getting dispersed, that they're offering them humanitarian visas or permission to stay in the country temporarily. Organizers say the caravan is not over, that this was a result of them putting pressure on the Mexican government to help get these people to where they need to get to in Mexico or the U.S. border.
So the marchers may feel victorious, but they fell short, didn't they?
No, I mean, the organizers from the caravan say they are still continuing north. So whether that is just Mexico City, where they will be able to apply for some kind of protection, or the U.S. border for some. That is definitely a misconception that these 1,100 people are going to storm the border. That's not the intention.
Why were these migrants marching in a large group? What does that actually accomplish?
Well, it's very dangerous to travel through Mexico when you don't have permission from the government to do so. I've heard stories of people who were on buses. They get pulled over, they get pulled out by immigration and sent back home. And so people who are trying to avoid detection, they take routes with coyotes, or they just go on their own, and you know, they go up through hills or really isolated areas. Those routes are very dangerous. Women are raped, people get kidnapped, people get beat up, they get all of their money taken away. So the whole point of the caravan was to give these people protection in numbers.
How many days have you been part of this caravan and reporting on it?
Well, I've been here since the beginning. Today is day 10, and that's involved walking, hitching rides, getting on buses. Sometimes the cities or the towns that we're in provide transportation so that people can get to their next destination. It's been a journey for these people. It's been tough, but they're very optimistic.
Yeah, I was going to ask you what the mood and morale has been like.
The people here, they lean on each other. They all come from the same background, and they're fleeing the same issues. I've seen one mother with four kids who are under eight. Sometimes the men will offer to carry one of them.
The bag or the kid?
Both.
Yeah.
Whatever they need.
It's rare that any of these people will win asylum in the U.S., but their cases can take years to make their way through the court system. What happens to them in the meantime?
If you are a single man, you will be put in detention for a couple of months, sometimes longer. Depends on whether you can get a bond hearing, whether you can afford a bond. Women and kids, for the most part, are not put in detention as long as the men. Some of the women from the last caravan who came, they're out, but they're wearing trackers on their legs. But the husbands are still, some of them are still in detention.
Adolfo, before we let you go, could you just tell us about one or two of the people that you've met?
There's this grandmother with her two grandkids. Her daughter was kidnapped, held for ransom. When she couldn't come up with $7,000, she was raped. She owned a bakery and she had to shut down her business because she couldn't pay the gang fees. And she finally decided to leave El Salvador when the gang wanted her 12-year-old grandson to be a lookout for the gang. And when she refused, they told her, fine, but your son can't go to school in this sector. And that wasn't the life that she wanted for her kids.
In Mexico, do you hear empathy from Mexicans who hear these stories?
Most of the Mexicans that interact with them are coming down to donate food, clothes, transportation, sometimes toys. You know, I had one shopkeeper wonder, you know, why are they coming? They know they don't want them in the U.S. That was the most, I guess, abrasive comment I've heard. But other than that, the people of Mexico are also kind of curious because it is a large number of people. But there's never been a shortage of people in these towns who come out to help them or give them food.
Adolfo, really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Adolfo Flores is an immigration correspondent at BuzzFeed News. He's in Oaxaca, traveling with a caravan of Central American migrants. Efraín Ríos Montt, Guatemala's former dictator, died on Sunday at the age of 91. The reported cause was a heart attack. He was a military general who ruled over Guatemala in the early 1980s, during some of the bloodiest years of that country's long civil war. He went on to serve in Guatemala's Congress, but a truth commission was rounding up evidence of crimes he allegedly committed when he was president, crimes against the Mayan population in an area known as the Ixchel Highlands. He was later tried and in 2013 convicted of genocide. Ríos Montt was able to get a retrial, and that had been underway when he died. Beatriz Mons is from Chile, but spent many years in Guatemala. She conducted field research there during the war. During the Ríos Montt genocide trial, she was the only foreigner to testify as an eyewitness. She joined us today from the University of California, Berkeley, where she's a professor emeritus. So, Beatriz, thanks very much for being with us. You conducted field research, as I said, in the 70s and 80s. This was in rural Maya regions of Guatemala. Now, the civil war went from the 60s into the 90s and has been summed up as a series of military dictatorships fighting Marxist rebels. But you've described what happened when you were there as ethnic cleansing. Tell us what was going on. What did you see?
The important period that you're referring to was 1982 and 1983, while the, as you describe it, the bloodiest period in Guatemala's history was underway. I went to the Ixchel Mountains during the reign of terror of Efraín Ríos Montt, and I saw the devastation he created. I went into areas that I was very familiar with, and I saw nothing but charred houses, fields burned. I mean, there was a feeling that not even an insect was alive. I continued going north up through winding roads, and I approached army-controlled camps where civilians were displaced from the scorched earth policies of Ríos Montt and interned into these camps. I saw men, Mayan men, Ixchel men, having to perform compulsory work for the military. There was just a complete devastation and destruction everywhere I went.
And why were the people, the particular people in this region, targeted? And how many people were killed, do you estimate?
Well, the estimates vary. During Ríos Montt's period, likely 10,000. During the 36 years of war, probably 200,000. It's very hard to tell, but there is no question that a genocide happened. There is no question that massacres, probably 600 massacres, were committed. We have the evidence, the bodies, the mass graves are there. And I think basically Ríos Montt and other military governments felt that in order to get control of the insurgency, they had to target the civilian population. And that's within a context of a country that has complete disregard, disrespect, despises the Mayan population. So for them, it wasn't a big deal to go and clean up areas. I mean, he was probably the most brutal regime in a region of Latin America that has had its share of brutal military dictatorships.
The war had been happening, though, for years, and Rios Montt was president of Guatemala for 17 months. I mean, many of the atrocities did not happen on his watch. Why has he taken more heat than any of the other dictators of Guatemala?
Because it was particularly brutal. The reign of terror was accelerated in a very dramatic way. In fact, he took power through a coup d'etat because he felt that the current military government at the time was not being harsh enough. He basically took the attitude, we need to really mean business here, and we need to bring this war and the internal conflicts to an end, and he knew how to do it.
Rios Montt was ousted in a coup in 1983, just 17 months after he came in through a coup, but then elected to Congress, and he got a lot of support, oddly, from the very same areas that were devastated by the war during his presidency. Can you help us understand that?
Well, I guess for outsiders, it's a little bit difficult to understand, but the chaos that was created during this period left people really feeling that some kind of order needed to be brought to the society. And many people had converted to evangelical Christianity, to fundamentalist churches. They felt that, like many people do sometimes, that there was a message from God that this person was for some reason in power and that he could help bring order into the society.
So not surprisingly, Ronald Reagan liked Rios Montt because he was a strident anti-communist, and Reagan wasn't his only fan in the U.S. There were also religious leaders who liked Rios Montt. Here's Pat Robertson talking about Rios Montt.
He's a terrific guy. He was with the El Verbo Church, and they had a marvelous government, but the left got after him, and he couldn't survive. They just went after him and attacked him and attacked him. The United States State Department went after him. It was terrible.
So Beatriz Mons, Rios Montt had been raised Catholic in a majority Catholic country. Then he became an evangelical Christian and his political career took off. How did that religious shift affect his political success? Was it crucial?
I think it was crucial because he, in a way, he was a very charismatic, for some people, leader. And he would preach on the radio, and in the rural areas, people had transistor radios, they could hear him. And he really felt that God had put him in that position for the reason that he needed to combat communism. The U.S. certainly supported him, so there was more evidence that he was doing the right thing. Reagan praised him. Reagan chastised those of us who were documenting and exposing the abuses that were being committed. So why wouldn't he do what he was doing? Why wouldn't he think that he was doing the right thing, given the support from the all-powerful United States? And he had the army on his side, finally with a program that was supposedly going to bring the situation under control.
Beatriz, you had friends who were killed in the war, it sounds like you probably risked your life to document some of these horrific crimes. I mean, Rios Montt died having been convicted but not having served a sentence. Was justice served?
Well, he spent a few days in jail, and that to me was quite an eventful moment for many in Guatemala. Yes, I had many friends that were killed, and yes, I did take some risk. One in particular, I was abducted and taken to a large military installation, and it gave me a little bit of a taste of the impunity of the military. I think justice was not necessarily served, but one has to think that he went to the grave as a convicted criminal, someone that was found guilty of genocide.
Beatriz Mons speaking with us from Berkeley, California. Thank you.
Thank you.
Beatriz Mons chronicled the darkest days of Guatemala's civil war and testified at the genocide trial of Efraín Rios Montt, Guatemala's former dictator who died Sunday. Just ahead, from textiles to automobiles, Alabama's new manufacturing attracts the big foreign car companies here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. A long time ago, January, in a galaxy that for many seems far, far away, the U.S. Congress, President Trump told us this in his State of the Union address.
Toyota and Mazda are opening up a plant in Alabama, a big one,
and we haven't seen this in a long time. It's all coming back.
The president said we haven't seen expanding auto plants in decades, but that's not true, especially in Alabama. Alabama's auto sector has taken off, and it's been happening over the past 25 years. It's now the fifth largest state for auto manufacturing, and thanks to German and Asian carmakers, the boom continues. Here's the world's Jason Margolis.
25 years ago, Alabama was known as a place to make textiles and apparel. Nobody thought of it as somewhere to build cars. Then the state lured the German automaker Mercedes-Benz with $250 million in incentives, a jaw-dropping offer at the time. Former Congressman Joe Bonner was at a University of Alabama football game shortly thereafter.
And they pulled the big drape off the Mercedes star that had been affixed in one of the end zones. And there were some boos. Mm-hmm. State officials were being introduced. And there were some people who thought we were crazy and had given the farm away.
Today, those state officials might feel justified in the high price tag to lure Mercedes. Since then, the state has lost 88% of its textile economy, 82,000 jobs. Auto jobs have replaced some of that. Roughly 40,000 people work in Alabama's automotive sector today. Besides Mercedes, Honda, Hyundai, and Toyota have operations in the state.
So at Toyota Motor Manufacturing Alabama, we are currently producing 3,000 engines a day. Those go into 5 of the 10 vehicles built in North America.
Toyota spokesperson Kim Ogle showed me around the plant in Huntsville, which opened its doors in 2003.
And today we have grown from 300 employees to roughly 1,400.
It's a huge, sprawling factory, a highly sophisticated technological assembly line. But during our interview, I noticed boards lighting up and music playing over the PA system, Beethoven and Bach.
So what you're hearing, the music that you're hearing, is specific to an operation.
It's a way for employees to communicate across a loud, expansive factory. Playing Beethoven might mean it's time for a supervisor to perform a quality check. The Indiana Jones theme song could signify somebody needs help. In a few years, Toyota and Mazda will add more music and some 4,000 more employees at their joint operation. To lure the Japanese automakers, state and local governments again offered incentives, more than $700 million in tax abatements, promised infrastructure improvements like a rail spur, and land for a factory. Huntsville Mayor Tommy Battle defends this practice.
You know, tax incentives are nothing more than an investment. In my business world, I would invest in a business and then expect to make money off of it. This is the same thing. We invested in this business.
These are non-union jobs. Still, the average salary at the plants is expected to be $50,000. And Battle says all those salaries could support 10,000 more jobs.
Person who might work at the drugstore or work at the grocery store, or maybe build them a house or something.
There are critics writing op-eds saying that local taxpayers are again giving away too much money. But consider this. Alabama's incentive package was actually kind of modest. North Carolina dangled $1.5 billion in incentives for Toyota and Mazda, roughly double what Alabama offered. A Toyota corporate spokesperson said it chose Alabama because of the location, infrastructure, and quality of life in Huntsville, and the local workforce. They come ready for the job with help from the state.
These stations simulate the movements of the various jobs at Mercedes.
Leon Gilbert and Yvonne Crenshaw showed me around a training center next to the Mercedes-Benz factory in the city of Vance. Gilbert and Crenshaw work for AIDT, Alabama's workforce training agency. AIDT regularly visits factories in other countries like Germany, then helps recreate German training back in Vance.
We've been partnering with Mercedes for a little bit over 20 years. This is a simulation that they're setting up right now. We set it up in conjunction with Mercedes because we wanted to make absolutely sure that our processes fit what they really wanted and what they wanted to, their employees to look like.
Employees like 22-year-old Cody Nichols. He'll soon be employed repairing Mercedes. He started with classes at a local community college.
Automotive classes, engine breakdown. You had a brake class, learning brake dynamics.
Then he transferred to Mercedes-specific classes on site, earning $16.50 an hour while training.
Now, inside the plant, we have more specialized tools that we get to use.
German tools?
Yes.
Can't say anything more?
No, I can't divulge any more of that.
Mercedes will need more skilled workers soon. Last year, the automaker announced a $1 billion expansion to manufacture electric SUVs in Alabama. Despite Alabama's recent successes, economist Dave Swenson at Iowa State University says Alabama hasn't tapped into some secret formula. States across the nation routinely partner with companies to create customized training programs.
It's not unique. It's not unique to Alabama. What Alabama, though, is probably doing is basically patting themselves on the back for being responsive and having very good feedback, i.e. their students are getting hired into industrial jobs that have, you know, they're relatively good jobs.
But he says if we go into a recession, taxpayers may get angry, asking, why are we paying to train workers for a specific corporation that's not hiring? Swenson adds that in the South, there's a much bigger draw for foreign automakers that rises above all else, cheaper labor.
Initially, half of the propensity to move plants was to escape union contracts and to take advantage of non-union right-to-work states.
Union folks up in Michigan see southern states and non-union wages as a race to the bottom. Steve Sewell in Birmingham views it differently. He's with the Economic Development Partnership of Alabama, a business-funded organization that works to attract industry to the state. To him, it's not about a competition between Alabama and Michigan.
I don't see how it can hurt anyone when we attract foreign investment to the United States that creates jobs. They're making contributions to not only our economy in our state, but to the nation's economy as well. They're exporting products worldwide, so they're a contributor to the U.S. economy.
Alabama shipped nearly $8 billion worth of autos to 88 nations last year. And Sewell and others argue that the state's car boom has helped lure other foreign manufacturing to Alabama, from Australian ships to European airplanes.
The automotive industry and the success that we've had in economic development has probably done more to address misperceptions about Alabama and the image issue of Alabama, that the state might be a backwater or a more backward state. It's demonstrated that we can be a global competitor.
And if Alabama continues to land foreign contracts, maybe the state will get another mention in next year's State of the Union. For The World, Jason Margolis, Huntsville, Alabama.
Jason's story is part of our 50 States Project. We're taking a closer look at how communities in the U.S. are being affected by globalization. If you have an idea for a story for our 50 States coverage, send us a note. We're at pri.org/50states. That's 50 states. Tell us what's going on in your corner of the country. I'm Marco Werman. In Mexico, more and more women are ending up in jail on drug charges, and many of them are single mothers.
They're engaging in selling drugs because it's an easy way to combine their child care responsibilities with earning an income, and they are looking for ways to put food on the family for their kids.
That story, still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Every now and then in the news business, it can feel like the past comes back to re-inhabit the present. And in the past few days, quite a bit of that. We told you earlier on the show about the legacy of Efraín Ríos Montt, the brutal dictator of Guatemala who died on Sunday. In a few minutes, we'll hear how South Africans are remembering Winnie Mandela, who died yesterday. But first, another personality who had, you could say, a symbolic political death, but now seems poised to rise again, maybe. I'm talking about former Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. It's been 8 years since he left office and about 9 months since he was convicted on corruption charges. Tomorrow, Brazil's Supreme Court is expected to rule on whether Lula will go to jail. But he's already announced another presidential bid. As you can hear from the crowd noise in Rio de Janeiro, Lula's still got lots of supporters. Reporter Catherine Osborne is in Rio and was at that rally yesterday. So it sounds like there are a couple of possible scenarios for Lula's presidential bid. But before we get to that, Catherine, how likely is it that Lula's going to go to jail tomorrow?
Tomorrow, the Supreme Court will rule on a habeas corpus case that could put Lula in prison immediately. But Lula has been ruled guilty for corruption, which means even if he's not put in prison tomorrow, there's a high chance that he could be imprisoned later on in the coming months. There's a law called the Clean Slate Law, which may put him out of the running for the election. And if he somehow does run, he currently has at least 8 other corruption charges against him moving through the courts, which is something that is very common for Brazilian politicians these days.
If he is sentenced to prison tomorrow, could he run for president from prison? Is that a possibility?
What he could do and what he's trying to direct his supporters to do is set up another candidate that he would endorse. And that's really what the rally last night was about. It wasn't about him saying he didn't do the things he was accused of. It was about setting up an argument that prosecutors and judges have pursued him more fiercely than they're pursuing corrupt figures on Brazil's right. And he said this explicitly at the rally.
Que me tirando do jogo, tá resolvendo o problema deles. O problema dele não sou eu. O problema dele são vocês.
He's saying they think that I was their problem. But their problem isn't me. It's all of you guys. And they are the judges and the prosecutors that are investigating him right now. And as you can see, the crowd loved it.
It's extraordinary, Catherine. I mean, all of these charges hanging over Lula, corruption dogging him for years, a lot of love still. You were at that rally yesterday. Why do you think Lula has so many supporters despite being convicted for corruption?
Over the past few months, it's become increasingly clear that Lula isn't the most corrupt politician in Brazil. He certainly participated in bribery schemes that awarded certain companies big contracts. But many other politicians did as well. Many of them are still sitting in Congress. And so Lula's supporters, especially the ones who were there last night, think that this is about defending the working Brazilian versus defending people who have privileges. Several supporters I spoke to are worried about the consequences of how strong the political right is right now. And for them, those consequences are worse than anything Lula did. So Yassi is a law student at the State University of Rio.
Claro, enquanto moradora do Rio de Janeiro, a gente vê que esse ódio.
She says she feels like she's living through times of hate. And the Brazilian right that's been growing more vocal does indeed have a hateful discourse on the issue of crime and everyday security, for example. They say that bandido bom é bandido morto, which is a good criminal is a dead criminal. This is the kind of discourse that's used to excuse police executions of poor black people in Rio. There's also a lot of homophobia on the rise. Hate crimes against gay Brazilians is on the rise. And so supporters who were at the rally are worried that the discourse of hate will result in real violence against Brazilians. And for them, that's more risky than having a president who participated in bribery.
This increase in everyday violence and the involvement of police in that violence and the hate that that lawsuit was just talking about, how do you think all of this is influencing the candidates and the voters? Like, how are they all talking about it?
What's interesting is that this may have changed in the past 2 weeks. Until then, this discourse was pretty popular among most Brazilians, and it was fueling the popularity of a presidential candidate called Jair Bolsonaro, who really defends this kind of tough-on-crime, authoritarian rhetoric. However, Brazil was really shaken by the events of the past 2 weeks. The political assassination of a Rio City councilwoman.
That's Marielle Franco, yeah?
Yes, and she was killed in a drive-by shooting. She's somebody who was very high profile, and a little over 2 weeks later, there's still no one been named as a suspect, which leaves all sorts of doubts about the case. Lula's own campaign bus was shot at 3 times last week. And the personal threats against the life of one Supreme Court justice and his family are also things that have made Brazilians wary and even caused the president of the Supreme Court to issue a rare televised address on Monday saying that Brazil was living through times of intolerance and condemning violence. What that could mean is that Brazilians who were excited by this tough-on-crime rhetoric and may have been considering voting for somebody like Bolsonaro are seeing already the consequences of that kind of rhetoric. And there hasn't been really convincing condemnation or investigation of these incidents by leaders on Brazil's right now. And so it's possible that the political violence will motivate Brazilians more towards a progressive candidate.
Interesting times in Brazil. Catherine Osborne, based in Rio. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Let's get back now to our investigation into the rising rates of women in prison around the world. According to some estimates, the number of Mexican women in prison has doubled in the past 2 years. For most of these women, their crimes were not violent. In fact, more often, they are drug-related offenses. It is true that some women inmates were involved with Mexico's drug cartels, but the majority of them were simply trying to feed their children, or they took the fall for their loved ones. From our Across Women's Lives desk, correspondent Jasmine Garz has our story.
¿Qué vienes a comprar? ¿A comprar amor o a comprar miedo?
What did you come to buy? Love or fear?
That's what Carmela Rodriguez Reyes says she used to ask people who approached her on the street she worked on back in the day. Most people came for the fear, miedo. That's slang for crack cocaine, she explains, which is what she was selling. She says it's called that because you constantly feel
el miedo a no tener más vicio.
Afraid of running out.
El miedo a no saber de dónde, de cómo le vamos a hacer.
Afraid of not knowing how to keep scoring.
Ese es el tipo de miedo.
That's the fear.
Mexico has been living with its own fears for a very long time. Since it started, the drug war has killed more than 200,000 people. But in a country where around half the population lives in poverty, getting involved in the drug trade can sometimes feel like the only option.
Que la comida, las escuelas, los útiles, la luz, el gas, el teléfono, el medicamento de mi madre.
Food, school, school supplies, electricity, gas, phone bills, my mom's medication. I started thinking, what am I going to do now? It's a lot of money. I can't by myself.
Carmela Rodriguez Reyes' unraveling began when her husband walked out on her and their two small kids. It wasn't just an emotional blow. It was financially crippling. Government support for single mothers here is meager. Alimony laws are not well enforced. Rodriguez started breaking under the stress, drinking a lot, partying. She met this guy.
Entre comillas, se podría decir que nos hicimos novios.
I guess you could say he became my boyfriend.
He was a small-time drug dealer.
Nuestro ámbito y nuestro ambiente ahí fue nada más.
As of that moment, everything around us was just drugs and getting high.
Rodriguez remembers one night she was stressed out about the kids and someone offered her a hit of something to smoke. And she says it felt like
como que liberada, como que se me olvidó todo, como
being
que
free.
Nada más
I forgot about everything. At that moment, it was just me. There was no one else. I forgot about my kids, my family, everyone. I liked that. I liked feeling that peace and tranquility inside me.
It was crack, and Rodriguez was hooked. And pretty soon, her boyfriend told her, listen, if you're going to use this much,
you have to bring the money. You have to pay for yourself. I said, how? He told me I had to sell. He said he'd teach me how to do it. That's how I started selling. I was still using.
Every morning in Mexico, on the cover of certain newspapers, there are photographs of corpses mangled by cartels or by law enforcement, contorted into what looks like a nightmarish sleep. It's almost always men's bodies. Few people talk about what the drug war has done to women here. But that invisibility, that's precisely what makes women great recruits for small drug cartels.
We're talking about people who are at the very beginning, if you will, of the drug trafficking chain.
Coletta Youngers is a senior fellow at the Washington Office on Latin America's Drug Policy Reform Project.
What we've seen is that a significant proportion of these women are single mothers. On the one hand, they're engaging in selling drugs or transporting small amount of drugs because it's an easy way to combine their childcare responsibilities with earning an income, and they are looking for ways to put food on the family for their kids.
For Rodriguez, the addiction took over everything. She stopped seeing her family for months. She was skin and bones. She'd stay awake for nights on end, afraid to fall asleep and wake up craving.
Sí, eso sí es miedo porque luego.
Yeah, that is fear. Because my body felt tired, but I wasn't sleepy. I wanted to stay awake because I thought, if I fall asleep, I won't smoke, and I can't. I can't not smoke.
One day, Rodriguez says she was on the street she worked.
Me senté en una banqueta abajo de la sombra de un árbol.
I sat on the curb under the shadow of a tree and I looked up and down the street and I thought to myself, what am I doing here? I'm not from here. What am I doing here? Why did I choose to be here?
She says she told her boyfriend that she wanted out, to which he responded, you leave when I say you leave.
El tema más doloroso y preocupante de México es la inseguridad. Todos estamos de acuerdo en que debemos combatir el crimen.
That's a campaign spot by Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto from a few years ago, promising to end violence against civilians. But by all accounts, what has happened is his administration has given carte blanche to the armed forces. If there was fear in Mexico before, things have gotten really terrifying in the last few years. 2017 was the country's most violent year on record, with over 25,000 people murdered. And a lot of those killings are related to drugs.
It was a sunny day, that day I wanted to stop getting high.
A few days after Rodriguez sat on that sidewalk curb, wishing she could break free, federal investigative police, a special task force created to combat organized crime, came for her boyfriend.
It was him. He told them it was me that I was selling. Yeah, he threw me under the bus.
Rodriguez says the task force beat her and detained her, which is how she ended up sentenced to 2 years and 8 months at a maximum security prison for women right outside Mexico City. Her boyfriend? She says he never got arrested. She says, as far as she knows, he's still out there, selling. Here's Coletta Youngers again from the Washington Office on Latin America.
There has been tremendous pressure on the part of the U.S. government for Latin American governments to toe the line on drug policies designed in Washington, one size fits all, no taking into consideration the realities on the ground.
She says the higher stakes players, like Rodriguez's boyfriend, stay out by giving up information. The low-hanging fruit get caught, which makes for great government statistics.
These women who are on the lowest rungs of the drug trade, they don't know who's running the operation, which means they can't plea bargain, and it makes absolutely no dent on the drug trade. Somebody selling drugs in the corner is arrested, and the next day somebody is going to be at that corner.
The prisons I visit are filled with women who had a boyfriend, a father, a friend, who they say got them into the drug trade.
If you interview a female inmate, she'll tell you she's innocent, that they shouldn't be there. But the majority of them are guilty. They just won't recognize it, even though they're in jail.
Professor Raúl Benítez Manaut studies drug policy at the National Autonomous University of Mexico.
Let's say 10 or 15% of them are actually innocent, but they're mostly guilty.
Maybe not a politically correct opinion, but many people here share this view. People in Mexico are really tired of being afraid. A lot of people want drugs and the violence to go away once and for all. And those people will tell you, to get things back to normal, people like Rodriguez need to be locked up, regardless of how or why she got involved.
I'm thankful to God for bringing me here.
To my surprise, Carmela Rodriguez Reyes herself says this prison is exactly where she needs to be. It forced her to quit drugs and rethink her life. She just doesn't think it seems fair that her ex got to stay free and keep at it. When we meet, Rodriguez is almost done with her sentence. She's thinking about being back with her kids. They've been living with grandma. I ask her if she's worried about getting sucked back into the drug trade. She says it won't happen. She says it will be better this time.
Now I only have love to give.
This time, she has no fear. For The World, I'm Jasmine Garst in Mexico.
Yesterday, this was the scene outside the home of anti-apartheid icon Winnie Madikizela Mandela in Soweto, South Africa. As you heard on the show, Madikizela Mandela, political activist and former wife of Nelson Mandela, died yesterday at the age of 81. Her impact on the struggle in South Africa was huge and also deeply controversial. My colleague from the BBC, Milton Nkosi, joins me now from Johannesburg. You were at that memorial celebration outside her house, Milton. What was the atmosphere like in Soweto?
Yes, Marco, the atmosphere was celebration. They were celebrating a life well lived. If you had turned up yesterday outside the Mandela home in Soweto's Orlando West Township, you would think that this was about a celebration of a party, something joyous, something about pleasure. But actually, these people had decided that they're going to mourn Winnie Mandela by celebrating her life in which she fought for their liberation from the white minority regime.
I've heard reports that Johannesburg went into the same kind of mourning, almost like the one that was reserved for Nelson. What did the rest of the city look like?
Yes, indeed. Everyone is talking about Winnie Madikizela Mandela, her life and her contribution to the liberation of black people from white minority rule, apartheid and colonialism, because she was such a fierce fighter. She never gave the white police who used to come to the house to arrest her from time to time. This is after Nelson Mandela had been sentenced to life imprisonment on that remote island off the coast of Cape Town on Robben Island. She was left at home with two young daughters, and she was harassed right till the end of apartheid. She resisted every single turn they tried to dehumanize her.
You know, I've been sifting through reports and obituaries since the news broke yesterday that Winnie Mandela died, and I've noticed two different reactions. The one we see outside of South Africa, Winnie Mandela, loyal partner to her husband, anti-apartheid activist, but then she did some bad stuff and went off the rails, and then a different appreciation of her in South Africa. What has been the reaction there? How do you see South Africans seeing Winnie Mandela differently from, say, the rest of us?
So here the debate is, how do we mourn the dead, Marco? Do we just overlook all their flaws and speak very highly of them? Or do we follow the Julius Caesar route? I came here to bury Caesar, not to praise him, sort of approach. And there is a huge debate going on. Most people in South Africa, generally speaking, feel that her contribution in the liberation struggle to free black people from colonialism and the brutal system of apartheid completely overshadows the flaws that came up. And truth be told, she did have some flaws in that struggle. You know that she was convicted of fraud, and she was also convicted of being an accessory to kidnapping. Later, that charge was reduced to a fine, and she never went to prison for that. And she had made some really powerful speeches, which put her in direct conflict with her own comrades, where she supported a violent means to deal with people within the black community who were suspected falsely of being traitors.
Milton, you knew Winnie Madikizela Mandela personally. What are we outside of South Africa missing when we try and place this objective lens on her life?
Oh, that's a very important question, Marco. I say this because I'm wearing my hat as a journalist, and I want to stay balanced, impartial. But the question you're asking is about my personal connection to her. I grew up in the same neighborhood. So in other words, I never chose to live there. My parents happened to live there. So I never had the choice. I grew up there and I knew her. I know her family. I knew her daughters. And she was just a wonderful woman. When I grew up, I remember that she was tough. But I also remember that she was visibly, beautifully striking, right? So she was, at the time when I grew up, our own Michelle Obama, if you like. Mm. Okay, she dressed very well. She spoke very well, intelligently, articulately, articulating the problems that people were going through on a day-to-day basis, problems that other people would never listen to.
So Winnie Mandela, the strong, forceful, but nurturing mother, and yet we can't forget her condoning the violent practice of necklacing political opponents or her thuggish Mandela United Football Club, where she allegedly ordered her bodyguards to kill people. I mean, how do you understand that part of her life?
Yeah, so because I was there, I kind of followed it quite closely. She herself admitted at the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was set up by Nelson Mandela to try and bring black and white people together following the end of apartheid. And Desmond Tutu, who was the chairman of the commission, pleaded with her to apologize or to say she was sorry for the many things that she did not do correctly. And she said, even though she refused to apologize for everything, she said at some times things, and I quote here, went horribly wrong. Mm. So if she herself said that, then you can understand that she acknowledges her flaws.
Right.
But be that as it may, she made some very serious mistakes. But that should not, on a day like this, overshadow the 81-year-old life where she spent most of her life doing right for the millions of people rather than concentrating on her flaws. And part of the debate here, and that's why your question is so important, Marco, is that we need to have some perspective. It's not like Winnie Mandela was a flawed person every day of her life and on one weekend decided to be a liberation hero. She was actually a liberation heroine for millions of black South Africans and kept the liberation movement going when most of his leaders could not do so. And then at some point, she veered off the main road and she was caught with her flaws. That is how it should be said. So facts must be stated, so you cannot gloss over those ones. Those lives count of those people who were affected there. But it's important to take a holistic picture rather than a pick and choose as far as millions of South Africans can remember.
The BBC's Milton Nkosi in Johannesburg. Thanks so much, Milton, for speaking with us about Winnie Mandela.
Always a pleasure, Mark.
And that's Our World on this Tuesday. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you all tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.